Christian Blood, KTSA News.
All right, I am living in their world, so you can continue living in yours. Keeping on top of all the litigation, legislation, obfuscation in the nation. I'll stop. And we're going to talk about what's going on in the world, what's going on in our lives. And you can join the show at 210-599-5555. We think any time now, it could be today, it could be tomorrow, the judge in Georgia, Scott McAfee, will who's overseeing the racketeering case against Trump and his co-defendants, will rule on the case and or the disqualification of Fannie Willis and her office. So we're awaiting that decision, which is a big one. Then we have the judge in Florida, Judge Cannon, who is overseeing the documents case and has been has received the arguments from the Trump lawyers as to why they think that case should be completely dismissed. It doesn't sound like Judge Cannon is going to be persuaded by those arguments. Then we have in Manhattan the Trump lawyers seeking a 90-day delay or dismissal of the charges against Trump. And the DA up there, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, is on the hot seat because he is saying he wants a delay. And they are panicking over at MSNBC about what that means. Is he going wobbly? Is he not ready? You know, I have to say, Alvin Bragg and Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade don't look like the best. They don't look like the A-team. I don't think these are the lawyers you pick if you're really interested in the legal intricacies or crafting the best case. I'm starting to think that, and maybe you already thought this, that the efforts to get Trump were always more about the PR of it than the actual nuts and bolts of it. I mean, yes, of course, they would like to see him in orange overalls, but I you know, they're not, these are not competent prosecutions. What they have going for them is they're being tried in places where the jury pool will be anti-Trump. And I'm not saying it's over, but it's pretty clear these are not A-team people. You know, these are not the best people. We're not sending our best. When you consider that no president, former president, has ever been prosecuted this way, when you consider that laws are being invoked that have never been used against a former or sitting president, you would think that you would really have sort of a legal all-star team leading the prosecution. You'd have hired guns. You'd have, you know, really heavy hitters. You'd have scary good people. Fannie Willis is not impressive. I mean, you can say a lot of things, but they're just not very good at this. And so you get the feeling that it's really the smoke and the fog of the confusion and the innuendo that has the most value. Speaking of innuendo, have you heard about the Aaron Rodgers CNN story? So CNN's response to the report that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. might be interested in tapping Aaron Rodgers as his running mate. By the way, I don't believe this for a minute. I think this was very, very good, you know, headline-grabbing, clickbaiting by the Kennedy campaign. My hat is off to them. It was a brilliant coup. I don't think he's going to pick Aaron Rodgers. And not that I don't like Aaron Rodgers, I just don't think he's going to pick Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers will hopefully be taking snaps for the New York Jets this fall. But anyway, their response to the story was that Aaron Rodgers is a Sandy Hook denier. that he doesn't believe it happened. That he doesn't believe those kids were killed. They never existed at Sandy Hook in 2012. Pamela Brown is the chief author of this. She's a CNN correspondent. And she says that she met him at the Kentucky Derby in 2013 and had a conversation with him that somehow led to this, to him revealing this to her. And there's a lot of problems with that story right there. I mean, you're at the Kentucky Derby and you're talking about Sandy Hook. And you're Aaron Rodgers and you're confessing a secret to a CNN correspondent? So the only author of the story or the only source of the story is that Pamela Brown says, he told me this. Well, he may have told her that, if you believe her, but this is what he told a local Wisconsin television station at the time that Sandy Hook happened, when it happened, and he was asked for a reaction to it. He said this, cut number one.
On that as well today, he shares what he hopes will come from this tragedy.
I hope that we can learn from this and look for the signs more and not ever have something like this happen and keep this on our minds, because these are things that affect all of us directly or indirectly, and this needs to be something that we learn from.
I suppose people can change their mind over time. And I will say, if it is true that Aaron Rodgers is a Sandy Hook denier, he will lose a lot of support, including mine. But considering CNN's credibility issues, considering the thinness of the sourcing on this story, considering the fact that Pamela Brown apparently has known this for a decade and never thought it was worth mentioning until now, until this week, until the story about RFK, so it wasn't worth mentioning when Aaron Rodgers was in the top of the news in the sports world, when Aaron Rodgers was in the top of the news for leaving the Green Bay Packers and ultimately going to the number one media market in the country to be the quarterback of the New York Jets. It wasn't worth mentioning when, dramatically, on opening night of the season, Aaron Rodgers went down with a season-ending injury. So all the times that Pamela Brown had a hook for this incredible factoid, she didn't use it. But she's using it now. Color me skeptical. Pamela Brown has some splaining to do. Anyway, we'll talk about that. 210-599-5555. Now let's go to Canada. Story's gone viral about how the Toronto police, they've since retracted this. The Toronto police had put out some anti-theft, you know, keep yourself safe tips because they have a crime wave going on. And one of the tips from the police was to prevent the possibility of being attacked in your home, leave your car keys at your front door because they're breaking into your home to steal your car, said Toronto Police Constable Marco Riccardi, no relation, at a safety meeting. Guess you're wondering, this is not a hoax. He's real. And he said it. Leave your keys at the front door. Why not just leave your keys in the car? Why not just leave the car running? I mean, I don't know where you leave your keys. Probably a lot of people leave them by the front door. And maybe it's true that home invaders are looking for car keys. And your car is not as important as you are. I get all that. We want you to live. We Don't want you to be killed in your home. But there's just something very surrendery and pathetic about telling people who pay taxes, who have an expectation of law and order, leave the keys by the front door. Why not just leave them on the porch? Label them. These are the keys for the black car. These are the keys for the green car. They are now backtracking on this. They had other advice. Put your vehicles in the garage. Keep your exterior areas well lit. Consider motion detectors, alarms, security film, locks, all that stuff. But there's just something about telling people to prepare for and yield to crime that is very on point for 2024. It's sort of that same concept of so-called leaders telling us to get ready for eating crickets and rolling brownouts and our best days are behind us. I was also thinking, as a side note, this almost seems to encourage breaking and entering, because if a lot of people took their advice, there'd be a lot of thieves who would say, all I got to do is kick in a door and there should be keys right there, or break a window and there should be keys right there. People are told to leave them right by the front door. I'm going to go score some cars. Gone in 60 seconds. So that's Canada. And the kid with the American flag on his truck has now been told he can keep it. But it's not as simple as that. Remember, we talked about Cameron Blasek yesterday in Indiana. It would be one thing if the school said, wow, we really blew it. I don't know what we were thinking. Or we're going to fire the guy that said not to have a flag. But in telling him that it was okay to have the flag, they're taking the position that it was always okay. That they were misunderstood. How do you misunderstand that? What nuance would there be in that instruction? You have to take your flag down. Oh, I have to take my flag down? No, you don't understand me. Why aren't you listening to me? So they're claiming it was never the policy, and we allow the U.S. flag to be displayed by students anywhere, anytime, they told a local TV station. So anyway, he gets to fly the flag. I guess that's the outcome that matters the most. You've heard a lot of talk about TikTok this week. The House voting yesterday 352-65 for a bill that would ban TikTok if TikTok is not divested by its Chinese parent company called ByteDance in the next 6 months. So unless they sell it to an approved buying group, investing group, the ban would kick in. This now goes to the Senate. Whether they like it or not, the people that are pushing this sound just like the Chinese. They're cracking down on social media because they don't want content regulated or controlled from another country. Well, the Chinese do this too. They don't let our tech companies throttle back or regulate data or impose algorithms. The Iranians are doing this. So we're pushing the same approach that they do, which I don't think is a great look. I'm not the biggest fan of TikTok, but I cannot believe the number of people on the right who are missing the point of this, which is that why would you give Joe Biden or any American president the same regulatory power, the same veto over internet content that she has or the Iranian mullahs have? Are you guys crazy? Yes, we have laws. We have the Supreme Court ruling that the Biden administration can't pressure social media moderators, but we also know the Biden administration doesn't respect that. I'm scared by the power that they have over the internet now. And here are so-called conservatives and Republicans arguing they should have more. It is crazy to me. We have no business handing this power, which we rightly don't want the Chinese to have, to our own federal government. Do you really think, based on what you've seen in recent years, that federal bureaucrats want to protect Americans from, quote, digital surveillance and influence operations, unquote? I think they love that stuff. And by the way, if they come down on TikTok, they are also de facto empowering and rewarding Meta. And who controls that? And what have we seen them do when it comes to our politics and elections and news coverage? Competition is the strongest force for freedom. Whether it's education, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's the internet. If you find a topic that is banned on TikTok or throttled back on TikTok, you at least can escape to other platforms to seek it out and or discuss it. But forcing TikTok under American control is a very Chinese communist way of solving the problem. And it isn't solving the problem. It's making a new problem. I want to play what the president of TikTok had to say about this. His name is Zhao Zhi Wen. Take a listen to this. Cut number two, right?
Hi, everyone. It's Zhao here. Just wanted to share some thoughts with our U.S. users about the disappointing vote in the House of Representatives. There has been a lot of misinformation, and I hope to clarify some things. First, thank you to our incredible community. You are what makes TikTok so special. Thank you for making your voices heard. Over the last few years, we have invested to keep your data safe and our platform free from outside manipulation. We have committed that we will continue to do so. This legislation, if signed into law, will lead to a ban of TikTok in the United States. Even the bill sponsors admit that that's their goal. This bill gives more power to a handful of other social media companies. It will also take billions of dollars out of the pockets of creators and small businesses. It will put more than 300,000 American jobs at risk, and it will take away your TikTok. We know
how. So his argument is this will kill our product. This will kill our company. I'm really not that concerned about what happens to his company, but again, I'm kind of blown away by the idea that we think the solution to censorship is putting our government in charge of the thing we're afraid is being censored. That should be your number one concern if censorship is on the table. So, totally the wrong approach. I mean, almost literally the worst possible solution to the malady. This is what Congressman Tom Massie said on the floor of the House. He's one of the few people, I think, making sense about this. Cut number four.
The gentleman from Kentucky is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I know the sponsors of this bill are sincere in their concerns and in their effort to protect Americans. They've described the TikTok application as a Trojan horse, but there are some of us who feel that either intentionally or unintentionally, this legislation to ban TikTok is actually a Trojan horse. Some of us are concerned that there are First Amendment implications here. Americans have the right to view information. We don't need to be protected by the government from information. Some of us just don't want the president picking which apps we can put on our phones or which websites that we can visit. We don't think that's appropriate. We also think it's dangerous to give the president that kind of power, to give him the power to decide what Americans can see on their phones and their computers. To give him that sort of discretion, we also think is dangerous. Now, people say that this TikTok ban will only apply to TikTok or maybe another company that pops up just like TikTok. But the bill is written so broadly that the president could abuse that discretion and include other companies that aren't just social media companies and that aren't, you know, as some people would believe, controlled by foreign adversaries. Again, we're giving the president that discretion to decide whether it is controlled by a foreign adversary. There were some people who were legitimately concerned that this was an overly broad bill, and they got an exclusion written into the bill that I want to read. It says, the term covered company does not include an entity that operates a website or application whose primary purpose is to allow users to post product reviews, business reviews, or travel information and reviews. Why is this exception in the bill? Why did somebody feel like they needed this exception if the bill itself only covers social media applications that foreign adversaries are running? These and other questions we hope to answer in the course of this debate, and I reserve the balance of my time.
All right, so that's Thomas Massie, the congressman from Kentucky, and you heard the president of TikTok. What do you think about this? 210-599-5555. Pass the House, it goes to the Senate. Has an uncertain fate there. Joe Biden has said he will sign it as soon as it gets to his desk, if it gets to his desk. We have some breaking news right now on KTSA. In Florida, Judge Eileen Cannon has just denied the dismissal of Trump's case on unconstitutional vagueness. U.S. District Court Judge Eileen Cannon dismissing the motion to dismiss the charges of retaining classified documents, which the Trump lawyers had claimed on the grounds of unconstitutional vagueness. Defense Attorney Todd Blanche argued earlier the Trump position is that the Presidential Records Act gives the president the authority to retain documents as he sees fit and to essentially take them home or out of the White House, and that that would be fatal to the special counsel's indictment, saying that every president since George Washington has taken material out of the White House, pointing out that then-President Trump caused these boxes to be moved while he was still president, and this is the first time the Archives Act has challenged a decision made by a president about documents. The U.S. District Judge telling Mr. Blanche, all that might be right, but I don't see how it leads to a dismissal of the indictment. It might be a defense at the trial. So that is where we're at right now. We're still awaiting a decision from the judge in Georgia and also a scheduling decision on the case in Manhattan. And we're talking about the Aaron Rodgers story in CNN and the TikTok story. The people raising the alarms about TikTok are not raising, in my opinion, illegitimate concerns. I don't know anyone, and I mean across the spectrum politically, I don't know anyone who completely trusts the claim that TikTok has no interference from the CCP. Everyone believes that there's an entwining of those two things. And people, I think, in the back of their minds know that when they use a lot of platforms, their data is harvested, stored, studied, curated. Stuff is pushed at you. You're profiled. And yes, I have no doubt, even if TikTok had never existed, I have no doubt that the Chinese Communist government has invested massively in money and in people to harvest and husband data on American citizens and American companies with nefarious purposes, and that at the appropriate time, they are probably capable of unleashing chaos on our financial institutions, maybe on our grid, certainly in people's lives. I'm sure all of that is true. So this is not me saying they're great and we should embrace them and nothing to worry about. But there's, you know, that saying, going from the frying pan into the fire. And I just think it would be incredibly wrong-headed to empower this or any president going forward to dictate what we can have, what we can see, what we can use, and who can own it. And by the way, most of the world is letting into their country and letting into the lives of their citizens internet product that comes from the Silicon Valley, that comes from our country. And it's not a rumor that our government is involved, has stepped into the boardrooms of these companies. We know that the Obama and Biden administrations stepped into these companies, gave orders, held meetings, coordinated the regulation of data, instructed them on things to believe and not believe, instructed them on what to block and ban, and they took those instructions, as do our telecom companies. Most of the world, in other words, whether they like it or not, whether they know it or not, are using internet products that the U.S. government has its fingerprints all over. So it's kind of ironic that the U.S. government would be so beside itself over the Chinese government having involvement with TikTok. But my position is I'll take my chances, you know. Let the buyer beware. Let the word go out. Let people be educated about the dangers and the vulnerabilities. Hopefully they are or will be. But boy, I cannot imagine. I mean, you can try me. 210-599-5555. You can try me. And I will listen. But it's very hard for me to imagine how giving Joe Biden veto power over TikTok is a good idea. The people we're expecting to protect us have given zero indication of their good faith. 210-599-5555. So if ByteDance, the company that owns it, divests it, and by the way, they say they can't even do that as quickly as this legislation requires. I don't know if that's true. They say they couldn't if they wanted to. If they divest of TikTok, it would continue to operate in the U.S. as long as the president determines through a, quote, interagency process that it's no longer being controlled by a foreign adversary. By the way, nowhere in the legislation does it say that the U.S. government will not control it. And the U.S. government is not confessing or swearing off its control of other things, like content regulation. If the company chooses not to sell, TikTok would be prohibited from app stores like Apple and Google, as well as web hosting services until they divest. And you may remember that when Donald Trump was president, he tried to ban TikTok through an executive order. The court said he couldn't do it. They also tried to broker a deal where U.S. companies, I think Walmart was one of them, would take an ownership stake, and that didn't go through in time, and the Biden administration stopped that when they took office. So this is where we're at now. It has bipartisan support. It's probably been voted for by congressmen you like. I think it's a terrible idea in a lot of ways. 210-599-5555. Chuck Schumer got on a lot of people's nerves today. The Senate Majority Leader gave a speech about what Israel needs to do about its government. You might say it was election interference. Cut number 7.
As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. Nobody expects Prime Minister Netanyahu to do the things that must be done to break the cycle of violence, to preserve Israel's credibility on the world stage, and to work towards a two-state solution.
I asked a friend of mine, an Israeli friend of mine, how people feel about Netanyahu, and he said, this was interesting, he said, The Israeli people are much more hawkish than Netanyahu is. They are much, much more determined to see this thing through and to show no mercy. He says, not very popular, but he's, and it sounded a little bit like the way people talk about Trump. He's sort of the leader they need, but not the leader they want. But for Schumer, of all people, the leader of the Democrats, the party that has railed against foreign election interference, to give a speech on the floor of the Senate. By the way, he didn't say this on a Sunday show or, you know, off the cuff at some fundraiser. He gave a Senate speech, read this into the record. I mean, the Israeli embassy had to respond to this. You people need to throw Netanyahu out of office. This was the response from Cocaine Mitch, cut number 8.
It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel. This is unprecedented. We should not treat fellow democracies this way at all. Things that upset left-wing activists are not a prime minister's policies. There is Israel's policies. Make no mistake, the Democratic Party doesn't have an anti-Bibi problem. It has an anti-Israel problem. Israel is not a colony of America whose leaders serve at the pleasure of the party in power in Washington. Only Israel's citizens should have a say in who runs their government.
All right, so we'll talk about this. 210-599-5555. I got to tell you, the thing with Schumer is telling, because this guy's been around a long time. You know, it's the same thing with Biden. Chuck Schumer has been in the Senate and in the Congress before that for decades. And you can go back, not that you would, but you could go back and look up speeches of rock solid support for Israel that go back many years through all of Israel's travails, through past terrorist attacks, through the assassination of the prime minister, through all of these things. But now, Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden are afraid of their young. They're afraid of their grandchildren. I don't mean their literal grandchildren. I mean the squad. The young Turks of the Democratic Party. They're afraid of them. They're bending the knee to them. So Biden wobbling on Israel, Schumer wobbling on Israel. This is about electoral college votes in Michigan. This is about losing House seats in Michigan and Minnesota, where there are Muslim American votes and Somali American votes, and they're making a lot of racket about their distaste for the Democratic Party. And Biden's, up till this point, support of Israel. So this speech from Schumer today, Biden's insane Gaza port plan, which, by the way, he says he can build with no boots on the ground. I looked it up. There will absolutely be boots on the ground. The army will have to stand on the shore to build this pier. There's a whole process. You can look it up online. There's diagrams. They have special ship that's just for this purpose, special equipment that's just for this purpose. They show you how it works. It's a littoral operation. It's got people on land, it's got people on the sea. The army has its own navy for this. It's kind of weird. These guys all know this. Or somebody around them knows it. But they're so afraid. And that worries me. Because we've always had wild-eyed bomb throwers in politics. But the way the system is supposed to work is it's supposed to be able to contain them. And it looks like the grand old poobahs can't contain the squad. They're bending the knee to the squad. That's who they're really catering to. It's not that they're directly catering to Hamas or Hezbollah. They're catering to Ilhan Omar, who is playing the Islamophobia card, by the way. I want to play you something that happened on CNN. They did a segment about Ilhan Omar demanding a ceasefire and castigating the Israelis for not showing up for the latest negotiations. And CNN's token Republican, a guy named Scott Jennings, just went off. And you'll be hard-pressed to believe this aired on CNN, but it did. Cut number six. Listen to this.
Scott, were you surprised to hear her say pretty clearly she would support President Biden in November? Some of her colleagues, I'm not sure they would say that today.
No, she's a Democrat. They're going to vote for Biden. I'm not surprised about that. I am surprised that in the year of our Lord, 2024, there is a public relations agent for Hamas sitting in the United States Congress. Mm-hmm. The reason Israel is not at that meeting is because Hamas will not provide a list of the living hostages. I didn't hear a word of concern for the hostages. You know, ceasefire, she said, don't happen magically. Well, you know, there was a ceasefire in place on October the 6th. And who broke it on October the 7th? I cannot believe, honestly, what I heard out of that interview. What I want are for those hostages to come home. And I want somebody out there to show just a little bit of remorse that Hamas broke the ceasefire, raped and murdered horrifically women, all kinds of people. That's it. How about a little bit of concern for those folks? That's what I'm looking for.
Wow. How did that get on CNN, right? Today's Thursday. Tomorrow's Friday. But if Bernie Sanders got his way, I guess today would be Friday. Bernie Sanders is pushing a bill to reduce the standard U.S. work week to 4 days. And when I first heard this, I thought they meant like you would work the same number of hours compressed into 4 days instead of five. Which I guess could work. But no, they want a 32-hour work week spanning 4 days. The 32-hour work week act, so-called, would reduce the work week from 5 days to four, from 40 hours to 32. It would be phased in over a period of a few years. It would lower the maximum hours required for overtime compensation. It would require overtime pay a time and a half for workdays that last more than 8 hours, and double regular pay if the workday is longer than 12 hours. What do you think about this? I mean, if your boss came to you and said, hey, you only have to work 4 days, most people would not launch into an economic argument about it. They'd say, great, thank you. But this isn't your boss deciding. This isn't the business owner choosing, working it out on paper, saying, I think I can do this. I want to do this. This would be the government telling businesses how to operate. And that's worked so well throughout our history and throughout history, right? It's been such a success all around the world when governments centrally plan economic activity. I mean, that has just been a grand slam home run. Prosperity, happiness, security. I'm being sarcastic. What do you think? Should we have a 4-day work week? Bernie, by the way, says AI is going to make this possible. You won't be needed 5 days a week because there'll be some robot doing what you do or helping you do it. He says other countries have reduced their work weeks, like France. I'm always a big fan of, we should always try things France has tried, right? It's always a good idea. They say that in countries where they've tried it, in places where they've tried it, workers are happier and more productive when they come back to work. That the 3 days off is exponentially better than 2 days off. I suppose that's true. I mean, just speaking for myself, it makes a big difference. It's a huge increase. It's a 50% increase in the amount of time you have off. And yes, a 3-day work week, I mean, a 3-day weekend is refreshing, rejuvenating. I get that. And I'm not saying that if somebody wants to do this, they shouldn't do it, because I'm sure there are businesses where this would work and does work. But should the government mandate it? You'd say, well, Jack, the government is already mandating minimum wage and other things. And the reason we have a 40-hour work week is a culmination of legislation and regulation. What would you think? 210-599-5555. Now, if you own a business or manage a business, what would this mean to you? I can imagine in some businesses you would have to ratchet up your prices, pass that along to your customers. You would have to figure out how to be, you know, people will still want what they want when they want it. So you will have to figure out how to meet the need. It doesn't mean, by the way, that businesses will be closed 3 days a week. It means that full-time employees will only work 4 days a week. Doesn't say which 4 days. Are they leaving that up to you, or will they let us know? So tell me how you feel about it, what you think about it, whether you work or you employ people, and we'll see where this goes. 210-599-5555. We were talking about the bill to require TikTok to be divested of its Chinese ownership and to put it under the control of the U.S. government, which is unfortunately an anachronistic idea. I mean, there might have been a time when Americans trusted their own government enough to cheer something like this on. There was a time when the, you know, Uncle Sam was synonymous with a force for good. But our own government has proven to be one of the great villains of the high-tech era, spying and surveilling on its own people, harvesting its own data, the data of its own people, and basically applying all of the pressures and influences on our tech companies that they are accusing the Chinese government of imposing on TikTok. It's literally the pot calling the kettle black. So why would you think the solution to TikTok, if it needs one, is handing control over to Washington? I'm curious about that. If you want to talk about it, 210-599-5555. Speaking of Washington, MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell had the foreign minister of Poland on her show to talk about what Trump said about NATO countries having to pay their share of the Russia-Ukraine war and paying into NATO. She kind of teed it up for this guy to attack or criticize what Trump said. And instead, I think he kind of caught her up short because he told her Trump is right. Cut number five. Listen to this.
What would you say to Donald Trump, who actually said that he would encourage Putin to go into countries, NATO countries, that don't pay their fair share?
Well, we hope that's just flowery rhetoric. He's right that we should be spending more in Europe. Poland is spending well over 3% of GDP on defense. And we've placed $50 billion worth of defense orders in the United States.
How afraid are you of Russia invading you? You're right there on the border.
Well, they've done it many times before.
Right.
And what they're doing in occupied territories, stealing children, torturing people, deporting people, exterminating Ukrainian culture, is completely unacceptable. You know, we've learned lessons from two bloody world wars that you may not change borders by force. Putin can stop this war in 5 minutes with one phone call. Unfortunately, Ukraine can't.
That's the foreign minister of Poland, Radoslaw Sikorski. All right, so We got a lot on the stovetop here. 210-599-5555. Tim is on the Jack Riccardi Show on KTSA. Tim, welcome to the show. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jack. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. So does Bernie Sanders realize how many manufacturing jobs and everything else work on, you know, on shift work, 12 hours on, 12 hours off kind of shifts, and, you know, what that would look like for, you know, our increased cost that would hit the consumer?
I doubt he does. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been in politics his whole life. He's never run anything.
Yeah, I think you're just going to, you know, increase the profit or increase the prices on anything that's made in America, which might be their ultimate plan, right? And, you know, get
maybe
manufacturing jobs out of America and then back into China for them. But yeah, that's just my take on it.
I thought it was funny. They even tried to bring up church. Tim, thank you. They tried to argue. Now, imagine that we would believe that politicians would care about this. But they said, oh, you know, if Americans didn't work so hard, and we could have this four-day work week, people might be more apt to go to church. Now, I don't know if that's true. I do know that these are the last people in the world who care whether or not you and I go to church. So, to me, if you cared about working people and what happened to them, you would not be dangling this, you know, trick-or-treat, four-day work week gimmick. You would be addressing what people are really dealing with, which, for example, is how many people in this country are having to work two jobs, or like a main job and then a side gig like Uber, to make ends meet, and they're not there with their kids, and they're racked with guilt for the stuff they're missing out on, and their children are bereft of the time with that parent. How many people are having to cobble together two or three streams of income in this inflation economy? And then on top of that, we see the statistics about not having any emergency fund, not having emergency cash, not having retirement savings, or borrowing against, people are now borrowing against their 401k like crazy. Credit card debt is going up like crazy. People are really hurting. And what they need is lower prices and an ability to keep what they make and an ability to balance work and life so that, you know, I'll give you 40 honest hours. I'll work hard. I'll more than produce. But I also want to be a parent. I also want to be a spouse. I need some downtime. I need to see what my house looks like in daylight once in a while. These politicians aren't addressing any of that. And of course, everything they propose adds to the cost of and the size of the footprint of government, which means we have to work harder to pay for their schemes and dreams. And all the while they're promising, this is for you, we're doing this for you, like an abusive lover. You never really see the payoff. Where's the part where it's for me? So I get that people want balance. But I don't think you can centrally regulate that or control that. And as Tim pointed out, there's so many different permutations and industries and situations where different industries, different parts of the economy just work differently. Shifts work differently. The service industry is very different from the retail industry, which is very different from the tech industry. I think the interesting thing about telling people, we know that you need more time, or we believe that you need more time off, we should really turn that on them and say, you guys don't need a new law to give us a break. If you want to give us a break, lower taxes. and let us keep more of what we earn. That's a more dramatic change in our lives than any of this other stuff that nibbles around the edges. 210-599-5555. Stop asking us to pay for other people's college bills. Haiti is kind of getting interesting. You've heard about the collapse, the imminent collapse of Haiti. You've heard the rumors about cannibalism and gangs. And I saw today a headline about Guantanamo Bay. Biden administration, this is CNN.com, Biden administration considering using Guantanamo Bay to process influx of Haitian migrants. If there is a mass exodus to the U.S., I don't think it's if, I think it's when, right? They're coming. We know that. The Biden administration is discussing using Guantanamo Bay. It's always interesting how when a party is out of power, Guantanamo Bay is the worst place, right? It's the stand-in for everything that's wrong. And then when they're in power, it has all these uses. It has all these applications. Gitmo on the end of Cuba is about 200 miles from Haiti. And the thinking is they could hold and process migrants before, well, what? Returning them to Haiti? Letting them in here? I see where Ron DeSantis is already deploying 300 state officials and an air and sea fleet to try to curb a potential boat lift from Haiti as the government there has collapsed and there are humanitarian concerns. They're seeing an increase in the number of migrants from the Caribbean on a daily basis. Just in a three-day period in January, they had several hundred Cuban migrants arrive in the small islands of the Florida Keys. So, what will Biden do about this? How confident are you that they're going to handle this? And they're obviously not going to keep people at Gitmo. I mean, you could hold a couple of hundred people at Gitmo, but if Gitmo is going to be like their Ellis Island for processing people in, I'm predicting they're coming here. I don't mean here, San Antonio. I mean here, the U.S. I mean, there's nothing in this administration that would persuade me or make me think, oh, they'll turn them around and send them back. No way. They will be coming in to this country. And maybe not through Florida. But think about the mischief that could ensue from this politically. I mean, I don't think they're worried about it. I think they're rubbing their hands together. I'm sorry to say this. I know these are human beings. I don't mean to speak of them like they're not, but I think about these politicians and I think we look to them, we as human beings look to them, all of us, you, me, some guy coming from Haiti, we all look to them like playing cards or game pieces.
Now, time. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the final countdown. Music.
I'm ready. Music.
Top 10 board. We'll start with number 10.
KTSA.
It's this week in 1986. President Ronald Reagan and new Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and their teams are negotiating nuclear arms reductions. Here at home, the United States is still reeling from and investigating the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger 73 seconds after liftoff. These were the top 10 songs this week in 1986. And we start at number 10 with George Michael singing backup and Nick Kershaw playing guitar. The number 10 song this week is Elton John's Nikita.
Oh, I saw you by the wall. 10 of your 10 soldiers in a row. With eyes that looked
defend the snow. On that key tie, you will never know anything about my home. I never know how good it feels to hold you.
A song about having a crush on a Cold War border guard, Nikita. This was the follow-up to the number one hit, That's What Friends Are For, with Elton and Gladys Knight, Stevie Wonder, and Dionne Warwick. Nikita at number 10 this week in 1986. The Thompson Twins, along with Thomas Dolby and Modern English, are on board this summer for the Totally Tubular Festival Tour. It comes to Houston on July 10th, and the Thompson Twins are at number 9 this week with King for a Day. Tom Bailey and the Thompson Twins, King for a Day at number 9. The song at number 8 this week is the first track off the self-titled debut album of Mike and the Mechanics, and also their first single. Here's Silent Running. Genesis' Mike Rutherford says, this song is about a guy who's traveled light years into the future out in space somewhere, and because he's ahead in time, he knows what's going to happen to his wife and kids back home, and this is him getting the message to them, telling them to be ready for anarchy and the breakdown of society. It's off its peak position of number 6 this week at number 8. Silent Running on Dangerous Ground, Mike and the Mechanics. Our song this week at number 7 will make history when it gets there. Rock Me Amadeus by Falco will be the first German language number 1 song in the U.S. This week it's in 7th place. Inspired by the biographical movie Amadeus, it's up 7 to number 7 this week. Falco and Rock Me Amadeus. At number 6, he was still John Cougar Mellencamp at the time, gathering up songs for his 7th studio album called Scarecrow, which was going to be a pretty somber album. Wasn't supposed to include an upbeat song like this, but he loved the song so much. It was so much about the music that had influenced him as a young man. He just had to include it, and of course it became the biggest hit on the album. Here's John Cougar Mellencamp, R-O-C-K in the USA. From Scarecrow, R-O-C-K in the USA, John Mellencamp. And that brings us up to number 5 on the top 10 hits this week in 1986. It's Whitney Houston's second number one hit, down to number five this week in 1986. Hard to believe, but this was a song offered to Janet Jackson, who rejected it. And it fell into the hands of the producers of Whitney Houston's album, How Will I Know? Whitney, at number five this week on our top 10 countdown from 1986. This next band was founded in upstate New York and had only R&B hits until this powerful breakthrough. It's Atlantic Stars' first big smash, Secret Lovers. Other big hits from this band you may remember, Always and Masterpiece. Secret Lovers is up one to number four this week on our Throwback Thursday countdown of 1986. This week in 86, this album, Welcome to the Real World, is the number one album in the country, and this song just was the number one song. It's at number three now, Kyrie by Mr. Mister. It was a huge album. It was a huge song. Kyrie, Mr. Mister off of Welcome to the Real World. It is making its way back down from the number one position this week at number three in 1986. Now, continuing our theme of songs that were rejected by other artists, this next one was offered to Stevie Nicks, who had no interest in recording it. Hart had just recently signed with Capitol Records, and while the band had previously recorded only their own material, they were so impressed by These Dreams that they added it to their upcoming album on Capitol. And this week it's number two. When it came time for Nancy Wilson to record her vocals on These Dreams, she was suffering from a cold and sounded kind of gravelly. After the song reached its success, producers reportedly wanted Wilson to recreate the vocal style on future recordings, jokingly asking her, "Can't you just get sick again?" It was Hart's first number one hit, These Dreams, and Hart at number two. And that brings us to this week in 1986 and the number one song.
Number one.
This week in 1986, another longtime act was having its first taste of number one, or actually one of its first tastes. It's the band that started out as Jefferson Airplane, then became Jefferson Starship, and then became Starship from the album Knee Deep in the Hoopla, with Mickey Thomas singing lead and Grace Slick providing the backing vocals. The number one song this week in 1986 is Sarah. I remember the music video from this song, too. Rebecca De Mornay, beautiful actress, playing the title character of the song, along with Mickey Thomas. So that's Starship with a number one hit this week in 1986, Sarah. Well, that countdown really brought back memories for me because I was in music radio at that time, and I played those songs as new songs. I remember buying the Mr. Mister album the day it came out. I think albums came out on Tuesdays back then. I seem to remember there was a day of the week that the new albums were available, and I remember buying that first day, peeling the plastic off of it. And also, this is when I was probably going to concerts a lot, 80s and 90s, probably for the most part. I talk like my life is over. I don't mean to sound that way. I just don't go to concerts like I used to. You know what I mean, though, Don? I mean, it's like there was like a window of time when I would do that. And to be honest, going to concerts coincided with getting free tickets through the radio stations.
Yeah. One of the perks.
A lot of my best memories were tickets I didn't have to pay for. So I started thinking about it, and I wrote a column today at KTSA.com. What was the best concert you ever saw? And we're going to open up the phone lines for that at 210-599-5555. What also put me in mind of this was I saw that Barry Manilow is coming to San Antonio August 15th. He'll be at the Frost Bank Center, and he's on his farewell tour. This is his last go-round of live shows. He's saying that he's not going to do tours. He's still going to record music, but he's not going to do tours after this year. And Barry Manilow was one of those people that I went to see in concert that I was blown away by. And I was not a big Barry Manilow fan, and I've told this story before. I went to see him at Radio City Music Hall because at the time when I was working in New York, there was this coworker of mine that was really wanting to take his wife, and he persuaded me, and I took a date, and I really went, not grudgingly, but I really went to the concert to see Radio City Music Hall, which I had never seen. It's the only time I've ever been there. And it's one of those venues that I'd always wanted. I guess it's what people call a bucket list. I really wanted to see it. And Rockefeller Center fascinates me and the history of it and all of that. So anyway, I thought, well, I probably won't really like the concert, but I'll be at Radio City and I can say I've been to Radio City. And I go in and we sit down and Radio City is everything I hoped it would be. But the concert was amazing. This guy, I don't know how he is now, but this guy puts on such a show. Great stage presence. He's funny. He knows everything about music. He's worked with everybody, tells great stories, sings a lot of different songs, energy. And again, this was 30 years ago, but I was blown away. It made me a lifelong fan of Barry Manilow, which you have, if you had told me a few days before that concert, I'd have said, you're crazy. That will never happen. You know, I didn't hate him. I just didn't really appreciate him. And then I saw him in concert. And I think a good concert can do that, right? It can either live up to your expectations, like I've always wanted to see this band and now I'm seeing them, or it can be somebody that goes way up in your book because of a great performance. So we're going to open up the phone lines here after the news. 210-599-5555. What was the best concert you ever saw? It was the summer of 1990, and I had just left a job and was heading to a new job, and I was in kind of a weird mood because of that, you know, kind of in limbo a little bit, not too sure I was making a good move. It was a move I had to make, but I wasn't too happy about it. And I had the tickets already for Paul McCartney at Sullivan Stadium in Foxborough. This is the football stadium the New England Patriots played in before the nice one they have now. This was a dump. This was a budget, you know, cinder block, bare bones football stadium. But what a concert. I had never really been a huge Beatles fan. I was just a little too young to really be a Beatles maniac, but I just had the feeling I should see McCartney. He was on his My Brave Face song at that point, and I don't know. Something made me get that ticket. It was a lot of money. I remember I took a date to this concert, and it was the only time we ever went on a date. It just was one of those things. I really don't remember. I know she was with me. I really don't remember anything else about it, except the concert was so good, and it felt like it went on for hours. This is when, you know, Paul still had Linda, and basically they didn't call it Wings, but basically the Wings musicians were on tour with him. And man, it was every song. It was every McCartney song. It was Beatles songs. It was the new stuff. And, it was just fantastic and just a great concert. Not because it was the perfect place, not because he was my all time favorite, but just the guy knows how to do it. And that's probably why he's still doing it. And I want to know what your favorite, all-time favorite concert was. 210-599-5555. Now that we know Manilow is on his farewell tour, and a lot of these people are, right? A lot of artists right now that we've grown up with are, you know, sort of wrapping it up or making their victory lap. So let's talk about that. We'll start with Brad on the Jack Riccardi Show on KTSA. Brad, welcome. Good evening.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you, Brad. What was your favorite concert of all time?
So my favorite concert of all time, I'm 27 now, so mind you, I was 7 years old. My dad drove us from Houston, Texas to the Cashada Casino to see Steve Miller Band.
Drove us
back that night, and then the next morning, we had to go on a 14-hour drive for a Boy Scout camp. But he drove me out there. He knew how much I loved. I don't know why I loved him so much at seven. I just did. And he took me out there and he brought me back. He's the best dad ever.
Wow. That is such a nice story. And that is very cool that at such a young age you had such good taste in music. Do you still like Steve Miller?
Absolutely. I'm an HVAC tech. That's what I listen to when I'm in work.
Oh, that is great. That's a great story, Brad. Thanks for calling our show, and thanks for sharing that. Steve Miller Band at Cashada Casino 20 years ago when he was 7 years old. 210-599-5555. All right, you're all time. I know you've been to a lot of them. We can't take them all. What was your all-time favorite concert? Who, where, when? And Tom is on the radio. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Jack. Yep, it was the Talking Heads. 1983 Stop Making Sense Tour.
There you go.
Upstate New York.
David Byrne. Where in upstate New York?
Poughkeepsie.
In Poughkeepsie. All right.
Yeah.
See, where I was, we kind of thought of Poughkeepsie as downstate. It's upstate if you're in New York City, but it's kind of downstate if you're in Albany and Troy and Schenectady like I was.
New York as opposed to downstate New York.
There you go. Yeah, no. And how was the concert? How was the show?
Oh, my God. I watched the DVD from time to time, you know, the movie that Jonathan Demme made, and it just brings back so many memories. It was such a great show.
Yeah.
The way the production, the sound, it was, nothing like it. Nothing like it.
Yeah. They were huge back then in 83. All right. Tom says Talking Heads. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate having you. 210-599-5555. What's a concert you've seen that you would, you may have to think about it, but what would be the best concert you think you've ever seen? If you can narrow it down to one. I'm getting a lot of email and a lot of people are listing. If you can narrow it down to one, 210-599-5555. Dave in New Braunfels says George Thorogood and ZZ Top in Austin in 98. Say no more, right? That had to be good. That had to be amazing. All right, John is on the radio. John, welcome to our show.
Good evening. This is a weird one, but I have to put Blackfoot, which is kind of an offshoot of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Mm-hmm. It was Ricky Medlock. He was one of the original members. And it was just something about it was so loud and so amazing. And it was one of my, probably the third real rock and roll concert that I ever went to. And they were unbelievable. Just unbelievable. And I have seen
it almost sounds like you weren't prepared for how good it was.
I was not. And they opened for a band named Crocus, which was a big, they had a bunch of hits in the mid-80s.
I remember Crocus, yeah.
Well, what's sad is after Blackfoot blew the roof off the place, everybody left when Crocus came on. And I felt bad. And those guys, Crocus lived in Lubbock, by the way. They're a German band.
I didn't know that. Yeah. It was K-R-O-K-U-S, right?
Exactly. And
I didn't know they were in Lubbock.
They took up residence in Lubbock. I don't know why. Probably college girls, but whatever.
That's funny.
Anyway,
all right, Blackfoot
was an amazing show.
Very good, John. Thank you for the call. Appreciate you. 210-599-5555. Michael is on the radio. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Jack. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. The King, Elvis Presley.
When did you see Elvis?
In San Antonio. I want to say about 6 months before he passed away. So maybe the early part of 77, if I recall correctly. He was in San Antonio.
How was it?
I tell you what, it was fantastic. He was already quite overweight at the time. But I tell you what, if you close your eyes and just listen to him, his voice was fantastic. It never left him. It was top notch from when he started to when he left. I mean, it was a great concert.
That must have been shocking to you then to have seen him so close to the time when he died. I mean, it was shocking when he died anyway, but for you even more so, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, it was like, you know, a dream come true. I mean, he was the man. He's always the king, and he'll always be the king. And to see him in concert, it was just, and we were about on the floor about 20 rows back. We had great seats.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable. I'll tell you real something, if you got a second, Jack.
Sure,
there was
sure.
a lady in a wheelchair that was in the aisle, in the center aisle, probably 10 rows back. And Elvis, you know how he takes his scarves off and he gives them to the people and this and that. This old gal must have been 90 years old. She was sitting in a wheelchair, and when he would take one off, all the girls would scream and put their hands up, and she put her hands up, poor lady in the wheelchair, and Elvis saw her. He got security to put everybody back. He went down off stage. He walked up to that old lady, put one around her neck, and kissed her on the forehead, and you would have thought that made her life right there.
Yeah,
definitely.
Probably did.
I mean, he was a good old boy. I like it.
Man, I love that. I love that story. I love that you called, Michael. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Well, I ain't super
There's one for Brad. Went to see Steve Miller when he was 7 years old. Only problem with going to see a great concert when you're 7 years old is it's hard for the other concerts to live up to it. But that's a cool story. I love that. I love Michael's story about Elvis. Wasn't that amazing? 210-599-5555. All right. The best concert you've ever seen, wherever it was, whoever it was. And Alex is next on the Jack Riccardi Show. Hi, Alex.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks a lot, Jack, for taking my call. My best show, and I've seen a lot, was at the Tobin Center 6 years ago when Alice Cooper came into town and performed the Dead Baby Tour, and they did the guillotine scene on stage. Wow. It really looked like his head was cut off and it rolled into the crowd. They went crazy. It was excellent.
That.
It was excellent. You have a good afternoon, sir. Remember VW stands for. Remember what VW stands for. Vanna White. Have a good night.
Okay. I always feel like I'm missing something. I feel like it is my show, right? But why do I always feel like I don't really quite know what's happening on it? Anyway.
It could have stood for anything, you know.
I was so worried. I'm still worried. 210-599-5555. All right. George is next on the Jack Riccardi Show on KTSA. Hello, George.
Hey, how you doing? Probably has to be Depeche Mode. Went up to New York in 2006 to see my mom after my dad passed away. She was there with my sister. But anyway, I got on the train and I got picked up at Long Island. So we went into Jones Beach in the summer of June. It was 45 degrees where the moon was full. I mean, beautiful.
Wow.
And they rocked. Great concert.
That's definitely an act I would love to have seen live. I never have seen them in concert. I've always loved their music. I'll bet that was a great show.
Yes, sir. Appreciate your taking my call, sir.
Thank you, George. You have a good night. 210-599-5555. Best concert you ever saw. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. I'd always been waiting for Paul McCartney to come here my whole life. And in 1993, they built the Alamo Dome. And like it says, if you build it, he will come. And he was there in 93. And oh, my gosh, it was wonderful. The first show in the Alamo Dome. And well worth the wait. Incredible show.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it was when you saw him, but he plays a lot of music, a lot of variety, great energy. You felt Absolutely. Like you got more than your money's worth, you know?
Oh, let me tell you, back then, tickets were $35 each.
Wow.
And everybody paid
man.
The same. It was a lottery system.
Yeah.
You'd go in 1 week, you'd get a number. You'd come back the next week, get in line by your number, and you'd get four tickets issued to you. And first come, first serve. And we got fantastic seats because four of us split up, and we each got a different number. And then we each bought four sets of tickets, and we picked the four best for us and sold off the rest to our friends.
How about that? Was that the only time you ever saw him?
Oh, no, I've seen him a lot of times. In fact, he did a better performance in 2012. I went with my son to Houston to see him, and it was even better. At that time, our seats were $200-something, and we had a big aisle right in front of us, so we had a beautiful, beautiful view, and we were on the floor, and the people in front of us, from there up to the stage, paid thousands of dollars for those seats. But there we were, one row back from them, with plenty of leg room and a beautiful view, and we only paid $200. So that made it even better.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good story. Great story about the opening of the Alamo Dome, too. Kevin, thank you. So another vote for McCartney. Best concert you've ever seen, 210-599-5555. I'll tell you another one that stays with me, and it's very different from what we've been talking about. But, Don, you know who Tito Puente is, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
I got to see him. He was in upstate New York, and he played a school auditorium. I really don't remember where this was. It was in some town in upstate New York. And I remember we went, I went with some people I worked with, and it had the feeling of a, it almost felt like a rumor, like maybe this isn't really going to happen, or maybe he's not really at this place. And there he was. And it was a fantastic, I mean, you don't think you're ever going to see a guy like this. I don't think he's with us anymore. I think he's passed on, but, he was great. The music was high energy. The crowd was just electric. And I felt like, yeah, I felt like I was seeing history. You know, he'd been around a long time at that point. This would have been in the 90s. And he was great. Speaking of the Alamo Dome, probably my favorite concert memory from the Alamo Dome was Fleetwood Mac. Anybody see Fleetwood Mac when they were there? It was probably about 1997, give or take a year. And it was not only a great show, and it's one of those shows you expect to be great. I mean, they're legendary. They've had so many good songs. But it was almost like a little value added to watch all the drama, because you could see on stage, like, Stevie Nicks was acting very weird, and she was going on and off the stage. And sometimes while Christine McVie was singing, she'd be like twisting a this piece of, she had this long black piece of ribbon, and she'd be like twisting it around the microphone stand. And I don't know if that had anything to do with the song, or if she was just bored, or they rehearsed it. I don't know, but you felt like you couldn't take your eyes off any of them, because there was so many little things going on, chemistry things going on between them. And great show, but I mean, they sounded great, had great seats on the floor at the Alamo Dome. I think it was 97. 210-599-5555. Best concert you've ever seen. Paul is on the Jack Riccardi Show. Hi, Paul. Okay, no Paul. Let me try. Let's see here. Let's try Mary. Mary, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Jack. I'm your regular caller. But I saw
And Tom emailer, Petty. Right? And emailer.
And emailer, exactly. Yes. I saw Tom Petty. I was a young soldier stationed at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. Hmm. And one of the lab techs asked me to go on a date. He said, we're going to go see Tom Petty and Stevie Nicks in St. Petersburg. But I had the flu, and he got really mad at me and said, you have to go whether you have the flu or not. And so, and I'm 5'1½". And it was a standing concert. So I remember it sounded good. I had the flu and I was forced to go. And I love Tom Petty. But it was, anyway, I never had forgotten that concert. It was the best. But
I don't know how to feel about this, Mary. I mean, were you glad you went? Or I don't like the fact that the guy made you go.
Well, he said to me, he was a young soldier as well, airman, and he said to me, I spent a lot of money on these tickets, but I ended up loving Tom Petty, but yeah. I couldn't see him because I'm short.
Yeah.
And but anyway, I love your show, Jack, and I love the gentleman that's with you. What's his name?
Oh, Don Cooper. Yeah.
I think he's a nice man, too. He has a really nice voice. You guys are wonderful.
Thank you, Mary. You're very sweet to say that, and he is a very nice guy. You pegged him exactly right. Thank you for the call, Mary. All right, so a nice memory of Tom Petty, except for the part where she was forced with the flu to go. And by the way, guys, as a public service announcement, you do not make a sick date go to the concert. Okay, I don't care how much you paid for it. You can't do that. That's not the way to do it. I mean, find somebody else. It sounds like she had a good time, though.
Caught in a quicksand, and I'm starting to sing. But I don't know which way to turn. I know I don't have much of a choice. I'll go out of my mind or into the night.
Don't forget, tomorrow night we kick into the weekend with The Dish. We'll be taking your calls to praise or zing your most recent restaurant experience anywhere around San Antonio or South Texas. So that's The Dish tomorrow night. Here, right now, it's a little different. What was the best concert you've ever been to? Whether it was around here or somewhere else, whether it was recently or a long time ago. If you remember it, if you remember where and when, 210-599-5555. By the way, I always like to throw in this little anecdote, Don Cooper, the actress that I went to the McCartney concert with,
mm-hmm.
when I met her, She told me she was going to be in a movie that was coming out, and she had a scene with O.J. Simpson.
Really? Really?
And it was one of those, I forget which one. Do you remember the Naked Gun movies?
Yes, I think it was, it might have been the second one he was in, I believe, was it?
Maybe.
Yeah.
My memory of them is kind of hazy. I've seen them all, but I don't recall which one. But whichever one he's in, there's a scene at the stadium. I think it's where Drebin's wheelchair goes over the railing. And she's in that scene.
Really?
And she was telling me about it at the time. And I felt like I should be impressed, but I really wasn't. Really? And, of course, this was before O.J. Simpson was, you know,
exactly. Yeah, he was still he was still O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, I remember. I thought it was very cool that she had met him and you know, worked with him and worked with Leslie Nielsen. And
but you were not you were not that impressed then.
We were not impressed with each other, so she was not impressed with me either. So totally
kind of helps a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, no, not
to be interested.
You know, radio. You've been to Hollywood, radio guy. Really? Come on, you know. So, but if you ever see that movie and you see a blonde actress with a very small role, that's who I went to the McCartney.
That's the one you dated.
Concert with.
Or went out with, should we say.
Yeah, went to the concert with, really. And that concert was so good, I could have been, really could have been sitting next to a stranger. It wouldn't have even mattered. 210-599-5555. And Heather is next on the radio as we talk about best concert. Heather, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jack.
Hey, Heather.
Hey, well, I'm just going to say I've been blessed to see some great bands over the years. My first concert was when I was 10. But my all-time favorite show was in the early 90s. A bunch of us flew out to Denver to see the Eagles at Red Rocks.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And they were absolutely amazing. It was one of those nights where just the mountain air, little bit breezy, and they played and played and played. And it was so fantastic. I will never, ever forget how amazing it was.
What a great memory. Boy, I'm just seeing that in my imagination as you describe it, the setting and the fresh air and the breeze and the mute. And that's the perfect music to hear in a place like that.
It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. Just, they all took turns playing their, you know, how Don Henley will sing, and then Timothy B. Schmidt would sing one, and it was fantastic. That was.
Do you have a favorite Eagles song? It's hard to narrow it down to one, but do you have one favorite?
That is really hard, but I'm going to say probably Take It to the Limit. I really love that one. So,
love that. Very good, Heather. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Great memory. Eagles at Red Rock in the 90s. Says Heather, I can't tell you why. Would probably be my favorite. But there's so many. I don't know how you pick one. 210-599-5555 on the radio. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Jack. Great show. Love it.
Thank you.
Best concert ever. July the 4th, 1976. The Liberty Bowl in Memphis, Tennessee. ZZ Top's Worldwide Texas Tour. Of course, they were headlining. Before them was Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Wow.
Before them was Blue Oyster Cult. And before that was The Outlaws. Amazing.
Holy
amazing God. Concert.
All that on one bill. It's like a lifetime of music right there.
It was incredible. I was 16 years old. I took my mom's Suburban with 11 of my best friends. We drove 100 miles to go see it. It was just incredible.
That sounds like a great story and a great concert. I love that. Tom, thank you for that. Yep. ZZ Top in Memphis in 76, the bicentennial year. Here's a cool one. This is from E.T. writing to Jack at KTSA.com. Saw Boston in the late 80s. My brother and I were in our early 20s. Saw them in an outdoor venue in Phoenix. Impressed with their musicianship. And this was another one I liked. This was from Brad. Says, I'm not sure what genius booked Liza Minnelli for the University of Alabama homecoming in 1974, but it turned out to be an unbelievably great show. At times, her mother's voice came through, even to those of us too young to remember her well. She was funny and energetic, wonderful. Liza Minnelli. See, that's kind of like the Barry Manilow story. Like, you go and you're thinking, this will be lame. How good could this be? This is, you know, this is my parents' music. And then you realize this guy knows how to do it. I mean, this guy's a performer. He's a showman. And I think some of those old timers, you know, they knew how to do a little bit of everything. And they knew how to put on a concert before there were, you know, giant screens and special effects and lasers. And I'm not putting that stuff down. It all has its place. Progress has its place. But, you know, if you talk about these OG artists, they had to entertain you with what they brought on stage. And they could, and they did. 210-599-5555. And Paul is on the radio. Paul, welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Doing well. Enjoy your show. Yeah, I've seen a lot of things from Deep Purple to Mountain to Ozzy.
Mm-hmm.
Aerosmith was great in the recording, but live, man, they were pretty loaded. So what I would say is Boston still.
Oh, when did you see them?
Man, I was loaded a lot of those years. Florida's 24. So I'm talking about Lubbock, Texas. I don't know what year it was. I can't tell you, but okay. Still to this day, I think Tom Schultz, or however you speak his name, is brilliant. The guy never needed to do any music, had great patents with whoever it was, Kodak or IBM, I forget. But
he created
a lot of effects himself. But that stuff, it was just like it was live when it was on the recording. Aerosmith partied a little too much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure any of these bands on any given night, you might catch them maybe coming off of a bender or not in their best behavior. But that's a great story, Paul. Thank you for that. Speaking of Tom Schultz, he was a technical genius. And I remember I worked at a radio station in Boston that he developed a piece of sound processing equipment that we were the test station for. And it was supposed to make, the idea was if you put this in your processing, your station's processing, radio stations often have an entire room full of equipment that they run the signal through. Don, you have that down the hallway from you, right? There's a whole room full of filters and devices that process the sound that goes out to the stream and goes out over the airwaves. Anyway, he developed this thing. It was a little box that you installed in your processing chain, and it was supposed to make your station sound louder. So as people scanned or punched up and down the dial, your station would jump out of the speakers at them, which was weird for us because we were a kind of a soft rock radio station. But anyway, they put it in, and we were told to really watch the levels because this thing was very sensitive. By watch the levels, I mean be very careful with how you brought up your microphone and the mixing of the music and all of that. And we had to take it off after a couple of days because it was so good, it worked so well, that you could hear everything in the room. You could hear the rustling of the fabric on the DJ's shirt. You could hear breath. You could hear hair moving. I mean, it was crazy. It was too, it vacuumed up. It like sucked up all the noise in the room. And there is noise in every studio, no matter how careful you are about that. Paper shuffling, putting a pen down on the counter, just anything. And it was too much. But yeah, he had a knack for that stuff, both for concert purposes and also for recording and studio purposes, the great late Tom Schultz. 210-599-5555. Best concert you ever saw. And Alan is next on the radio on KTSA. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank
you. Led Zeppelin, 1975 in Houston.
Mm. Mm. Where in Houston were they?
Well, they were supposed to be at the Summit, and they canceled that one and moved it a few months later to the Coliseum. I don't exactly remember what the name of the venue was.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I bet that was amazing.
Elvis in the Astrodome.
1975.
Elvis in the Astrodome. Wow. You got some good memories there, Alan. You've done some things right there. I like that. Teresa is on the Jack Riccardi Show. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'm dating myself. I took the bus to Hartford. I think it was the Bushnell. I saw Frank Sinatra in 1950.
Wow. In 1950. All right. So
yes.
This is like Frank Sinatra post-World War II. He's not the little skinny teenager guy anymore.
Well,
what was he like?
Pretty skinny. He was still pretty skinny. And, of course, as a teenager, we jumped and we screamed. And
yeah.
Anyhow, that's... I've seen a lot of concerts, but that's memorable.
And did it live up to what you expected of it?
I think it did.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's so much hype with somebody like him. It's almost hard to live up to, right?
Right. But I was a teenager. So,
that's right.
You know,
yeah.
My expectation wasn't probably as great as somebody else's.
There you go. That's a great memory, and it's great that you still remember that. Teresa, thank you for that. Appreciate it. And I don't think you're dating yourself at all. I think mentioning Frank here is, I was hoping somebody would. Let me get to Jennifer next on the radio. Hi, Jennifer.
Oh, gosh, Jack. I'll never forget seeing Elvis Presley in Las Vegas when you dressed up like you dressed to the kill. I was in my home. I had to be 19, 20. And I went with my sister-in-law, and she knocked all those women out of the way, ran up to the stage and got us. She threw herself at him and said, Elvis, I love you.
Yeah.
And he looked down at her and he handed her. I thought I was going to faint.
Wow.
I honestly thought I was going to faint. And when I think about that scarf, she was going to cut it in half and give it to me. I said, no, you keep it. And my mother washed that darn scarf and ruined it.
She washed it?
She washed. For some reason, my mother.
She has to be the only person ever that washed an Elvis scarf.
And ruined the damn scarf. And I was I said to her, oh, it's a good thing my mother's dead because I would have killed her. I mean.
Oh.
But also, I have to say, I met you at Magnolia. I'm the Magnolia Pancake House. Years ago, I got invited, and it was a thriller. You were on my bucket list. So,
oh, that's very nice.
You're a sweetheart. You are a sweet, and I'm 75 now, and you're a wonderful man. And I love your show.
That.
I listen to you with the headphones on. You know, every night you're a blessing. So,
thank you, Jennifer. So are you. So are you.
Blessing.
You made my night with that, and I love the Elvis story, except for the scarf. And I'm glad you called.
I know. You take care. Good night.
You too, Jennifer. Bye. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, on the JR poll, threw in a question about the upcoming total eclipse, April 8th. How excited are you about that? Very, said 40%. A little, said 36%, and not, said 23%. We'll have a new JR poll question tomorrow when we go live at 4. Don't forget you can find this show as an on-demand podcast anytime at ktsa.com. We're going to leave you tonight with this week's number one song from 1986. Lead singer Mickey Thomas, the last band member still to perform under the Starship name. And here was their number one hit, Sarah.